let's get started. So quick recap of last class. So we were talking about file organization. Okay, how file system should organize files on disk. We looked at three very simple techniques. First was each file is laid out contiguously on disk. The problem with this approach was that it was going to result in fragmentation. It doesn't allow you room to grow the file. If there is no space, you have to move the entire file. Okay. The advantage of this approach is it's the most efficient in terms of disk seek time and rotational latency. Okay. So this kind of file system is used in only special circumstances. In CDs and DVDs, you use contiguous layout. But in any file system where you can update files after creation, this is not a good idea because of fragmentation. Okay. So the next organization we looked at was that of linked list. So there you have blocks, files are chopped up into blocks. Each block, basically at the end of each block, is a pointer to the next block of the file. Okay. Linked list organization allows room to grow for a file to grow arbitrarily. It is reasonably efficient for sequential access, not so for random access. Okay. Random access degenerates to sequential linear scan to whichever data block you are looking for. Okay, and the last two things we looked at were indexed files. Okay, we basically have metadata for the file where there is a list of blocks. Okay, so it's an array, so you can look up the ith entry that tells you where the ith block of the file is. Okay, we looked at a fixed size descriptor and then we looked at multi-level index structure which is used in Unix-like file system like such as inodes, called inodes. Okay. So there are a couple of slides that I did not cover. Let me finish those and then we will talk more about disks and disk scheduling today. So for any file system, you have to keep track of where you have free space on disk. Okay, just as in virtual memory management, you kept track of free pages, you have to do the same thing for file system. Okay, so it depends on which organization you can use different data structures. Okay, in a linked list organization, the free blocks themselves can be kept as a linked list. Okay, so if you need some blocks, just look at the head of the list and you take how many more blocks you want and you are done. Okay, in other organization, in the index node organization, you keep a bitmap. Okay, presume you all know what a bitmap is. A bitmap is basically an array of bits. Okay, and the ith bit can be 0 or 1. If it's 0, it says that block, the ith block on disk, is available. If it's 1, it says it's currently allocated to some file. Okay? So when you need to allocate a block, we'll just scan through this bitmap. And moment you find a 0 somewhere, you know that's a block that's available. So that block can be allocated to a file. Okay? So allocation and deallocation of the disk space require manipulation of this bitmap. Okay? But bit manipulation is efficient on most processors, so this is not very difficult to do. Okay, so you can keep track of a bitmap like this, and basically as you free blocks, you just reset those corresponding bits from 1 to 0. As you allocate blocks, you can then go and set those bits. And you can also do things like if you want to try to allocate chunks of the blocks of the file contiguously, you have to look for a run of zeros. So here you need a 3-block file. If you find 3 consecutive zeros, those are 3 consecutive sectors or blocks. Okay, so you can find those and allocate those and your disk performance will be enhanced. Okay, so you can do things like this, do efficient manipulation of this bitmap to do layout. Okay, so this is something the operating system has to do. Okay, so there's a problem here which says how large can the bitmap be? Okay, so if you have a 2 GB disk, which is really small at this point, so really you should be talking about 200 GB, and let's assume it's 2 GB with 512 byte sectors. Okay, so you need a bitmap with 4 million entries. Okay, that's around 500 KB. That's okay. You can keep 500 KB in memory. Okay, you have plenty of RAM, so that's not a problem. Now let's assume that it's a 2 TB disk, not a 2 GB disk. So now you need 1,000 times that. Okay, that's the size of your bitmap. Okay, there are several. So you went from 500 KB to 1,000 times that's around 50 or 60 MB. Okay? Now you can ask, do you want to keep a bitmap that large in RAM at all times? You probably don't want to do that because you're wasting some of your RAM just to keep a very large data structure. Okay. So then you have to basically ask how will you then make more efficient use of the free space and yet keep the memory overheads manageable. So you basically have to then partition your disk into zones. For each zone you can keep a bitmap, so you can say first 100 tracks is zone 1, next 100 tracks is zone 2, the one after that is zone 3, so you can keep a bitmap per zone and you can only keep few of these bitmaps in memory. So you don't need the entire disk. If you're just looking for free space, you can just look at any one of those bitmaps and find the blocks. Okay? When you delete files, you look at what zone it belongs to, you read in that bitmap, you update it and you can write it back. Okay? So you can do things like this. Okay, so there are several other implementations. You can keep a data structure of free blocks, which is linked list organization, in memory and so on. Okay? But on disk, you essentially keep a bitmap. So keep this in mind, because Lab 3 is going to require you to do all of this. Okay, so you are going to implement a toy file system with inode structures and you will have to implement your free block list as a bitmap. Okay, and you are going to have to do all of this. Any questions on this before I move on? Yes? No? Yes. When is it going to come out? It's going to come out late this week or early next week, before the Thanksgiving break. Okay, and it's going to be due after the Thanksgiving break. Okay, so what I have to do for the rest of today is talk about, so until now we have looked at how files are laid out on this. That's called the placement problem in file systems. Okay, how is the file system organizing the disk space and managing files? What we are going to do today is the retrieval problem. How is data read out from disk? Okay, if the file system receives a sequence of reads or writes, okay, and these reads or writes are accessing blocks that are at different locations on disk, in what order should you service these requests? Does it matter? Okay, from let's say response time or throughput or latency, which scheduling policy would you use and so on. Okay? So in other words, we are basically going to talk about disk scheduling. Okay, so how to schedule a sequence of requests that are arriving at a magnetic disk. Okay, keep in mind that we are going to talk about again our traditional magnetic disk, and I brought one. Okay, so that's what a typical disk looks like. If you open, I wanted to actually open this so you could see that there are platters, but I didn't have a screwdriver, so I ran out of time to find one. But what is in here is essentially, this is a standard DVD, platters like this. So they are stacked in here, so that's why it's this thick. You may have about 10 or 15 of these. They are all spinning, okay, all at the same time. Each of them has a disk head that is basically positioned. And so this thing is spinning and the disk head is going to then position itself somewhere here, and then where it's positioned you can read data that's written underneath. Okay, this is how disks work. Okay, I mentioned this two classes back. So essentially whenever you want to read or write to disk, you issue a command to the disk, and then what the disk controller, which is hardware, does is it first does a seek of the disk head. Okay, the seek basically causes the disk head to move to the right track. Okay, so that's the time that is taken to move the disk head to the right track. The rotational latency is the time it takes for the right sector to spin under. Okay, so if you are trying to read this sector here, you have to wait for that to spin under the disk head. That's called rotational latency. And then you have transfer time. Okay, transfer time is the time that's actually taken to read the sectors that you have asked for. Okay, so typically any disk request, the latency of a disk request consists of the seek time plus the rotational latency plus the transfer time. Okay, of this the useful work is done only when you do the transfer. This is wasted work. Okay, so what we will do now is we'll take a look at how you can reduce this wasted work. For a sequence of requests, can we reorder this request somehow and service them in a different order from that from the one that arrived at disk, so that you can minimize some of these overheads. Okay. This problem is referred to as disk scheduling. Okay, so before we even go there, I want to present a table which shows you some typical hardware specs for magnetic disk. Okay, so a disk like this, this is actually an old disk, 80 gigabytes. Okay, so it says it's 7200 RPM. Yes, yeah, so actually it's sort of in this category. So you can see that there are, so that second row here tells you how many of these platters are in here. Okay, so that disk has 16 platters. So you have 16 of these things stacked in here. Okay, so each has its own recording surface and there's data recorded on each. Okay, yes, question. If you have double-sided recording, which some disks do, then you would have 8. Some disks, only the double-sided, the recording is only more recent. Okay, earlier disks would only record single-sided. If you are double-sided, then the disk head needs to be sort of read on both surfaces. Okay, so you need sort of more complex disk. Okay, so you have platters, then there are tracks. Tracks are the number of these concentric circles on these. So you can see there are 16,000, so that's basically the number of those circular tracks. There are 16,000 of these. Okay, on tip this one has about 6,063 sectors. Okay, each track has certain number of sectors. As I mentioned earlier, the number of sectors per track doesn't have to be constant. Okay, if you have uniform recording density, okay, so you basically will not have constant number of sectors. Okay, if you are non-uniform, then the sectors become bigger, the same number of sectors. Okay, so typically, disks have zones. So inner sectors are small, so they will have fewer inner tracks rather are small. Excuse me. So they will have fewer sectors. Outer sectors are bigger. Okay, so they outer tracks. So they will have more sectors. Okay, so that's how typical disks are built. This is the rate at which these things spin. Okay, so 7,200, 15,000 RPM. 15,000 is sort of modern disks. Okay, so I don't think they have gone beyond that. If you take typical laptops, they have slower spinning disks. Okay, to save battery power. The faster you spin the disk, the more energy it takes. If you have something that runs off battery power, that is basically detrimental to battery life. Okay, so if you have any laptop life device, you look at the typical disk spec, they will have lesser RPMs. If you look at server class machines, they will basically have higher RPMs because you need more performance. Okay, the faster it spins, the faster you can read data. Okay, that should be clear, because if you want to read an entire track, you have to wait for the disk to spin once. If it spins faster, you can read the track faster. Okay, so faster spinning disks have better performance. And they also cost more as a result. Okay, these are typical seek times and rotational latency. I mentioned they are in the order of few milliseconds. So if you have an average seek and average rotational latency per request, you are basically paying an 8 millisecond overhead for every request. Say 8 millisecond tax before you can do any useful work. Okay, because you will have to do a seek and you will have to wait for the right sector to spin by. So for each request, first 8 millisecond, nothing is going to happen. The disk is just moving, positioning itself, and then you can read or write data. Okay. So then there are some other things like buffer sizes and so on, which we will not worry about. Okay. So this gives you some notion of what the specs of typical disks look like. Okay. So as the capacity grows, one of two things happen. Okay. The number of platters increases. If you can pack more of those, you can store more bits. Okay. So higher capacity disks will have more platters, okay, and they will have more tracks. So you will record more closely one. So you'll have more cylinders. That means you can put more stuff on one platter, and you'll have more platters, so you can put more bits. So that's how you increase disk capacities. Okay. Alright. So with that, let's talk about, yes, your question.
So when you say there's 16 platters per pack, is that 16 physical platters or is that 16 sides that we can write on?
So it depends on whether the disk is can record on both sides or one. If you are dual side recording, then you will have that is 16 platters, but then you will have 32 surfaces to record. Okay, so that is just saying how many of these things are in there. If it's single sided recording, then if there are 16 platters, there are 16 surfaces. Okay. So now let's talk about the problem of disk reducing. So what we want is to reduce the wasted time that the disk spends in positioning the disk head. Okay, so we can see what are the various things one can do. Okay, so to minimize seek time and rotational length. The first few things are actually hardware optimizations, and the last few will be things we can do in the operating system. Okay, so first thing you can do is, if you want to reduce seek time, you can make the disk smaller. Okay, so this is, I think, a 3.5-inch disk. Okay, what's in your laptop is, I think, 2.5-inch disks. What you get in your iPods, okay, the old iPod, not the flash-based, were 1.8-inch disks. Okay, this, as the disks get smaller, these become smaller. Okay, if this is smaller, then the time it takes for the head to move from the inner track to outer track is going to keep shrinking, because these are smaller and smaller platters. Okay, then the total seek time will become smaller. If you make the disk smaller, seek time will fall. Okay, so you can use smaller disks to reduce seek time. Okay, you can make the disk spin faster. That will reduce what?
Rotational latency.
Okay, so if you make the disk spin faster, the rotational latency has to go down. If you make the disk spin twice as fast, the average rotational latency has to come down by half. Okay, because it will take half as much time for the sector to spin, the disk is spinning twice as fast. Okay. So you can do those two things. That requires you to buy a different kind of disks. Okay, so then your seek time goes down. The two other things you can do in software, is one is, you can schedule disk operation to minimize latency. Okay, you can reorder requests and reduce the seek over it, and we will see how to do that today. Okay, that's called the problem of disk scheduling. The other thing you can do to reduce disk overheads is make the file system smarter about how it stores data on disk. Okay, if you store blocks of the file close to one another, adjacent sectors, adjacent tracks, then you will spend less time in doing seeks and rotational latency when you try to read a file. Okay, because the blocks are close, so seeking from one track to another takes much less time than seeking from one end of the disk to another. That's basically going to take a much longer seek time. Okay. This figure here is an average seek. Okay. Minimum seek is on the order of less than a millisecond. That's basically just going from one track to the next track. That's the minimum seek. The max seek is basically almost twice of this. Okay. That's going from the innermost track to the outermost track. That takes the most time. On an average, you will basically traverse a third of this distance. That is that latency. Okay, so that's not a constant. That's just an average number. For different requests, you may have less or more than that overhead. And same is true of rotational latency. Is that clear? Okay. Okay, so you can lay out this better, and then you can do some of this. Okay. Now, the note there is saying that whatever I'm going to talk about in today's lecture becomes redundant once these kinds of disks go away. If you have solid state disks, then there is no overhead to go and fetch some block. Okay, so there is no notion, there is nothing moving. So you can access any block of the disk at constant time. There is no, just the sort of the electronic switching overhead is all you have. There is no physical disk head movement. Okay, so all of these optimizations are only necessary for these kinds of traditional disks. Okay, not solid state disks. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so let's look at several. We'll look at four different scheduling algorithms. We'll start with always the simplest one, which happens to be FIFO FCFS, which we always start with. Okay, we'll see how that works. Then we'll do another one called shortest seek time first. Okay. And then we are going to do two algorithms called scan and C-scan, okay, which is what most disk hardware will do for you. All of this stuff, okay, can be done in software at the operating system level. It can also be done in hardware. Okay, each of these disks actually have a controller. Okay, so this stuff that you see here, that's a microcontroller. So when you send it, let's say, n requests all at once, it can do the reordering for you and do some of this. So some of these algorithms are built in hardware on the disk controller, and some of these can also be implemented in software at the driver level. Okay, this is done either in the disk driver or in hardware. Okay, so at this point, we'll not worry about where it is implemented. The optimization works equally well in regardless of where it's done. Yes.
My question is going to be: is hardware faster than software?
Is hardware faster than software? All these algorithms are doing is saying, given n requests that all came at once, in what order am I going to service them? Once you determine the ordering, it makes no difference whether you do it in hardware or software. So in some sense, the overhead doesn't really matter. Okay, the overhead of scheduling is not the big problem. The problem is to reduce seek time. Okay, so you can do it in either place. Okay, so we are going to start with FCFS. Okay, so we will learn about each of these by doing some exercises. Okay, we'll show you how the disk head works. So what this is, these are tracks. Okay, so think of this as I took a cross section of this disk here, and each of the tracks are basically shown this way, and that's time, and these are track numbers. So this is the innermost track is 0, the outermost track here is 100. Okay, the disk head is currently positioned here. Okay, the disk head can move back and forth. We can make it move wherever we want. We can say to the disk head, issue a hardware command saying go to track 100, it will move here. So it will move in. You say go to track 80, it will move outwards. Okay, so you can make the disk head go back and forth. Okay, and then we can see how much disk seek overhead we will incur. Okay, so FCFS is the simplest. Okay, so it is just going to service disk requests in the order in which they appear. Okay, here I am going to show you a simplified version of disk scheduling. We are only looking at track numbers. Okay, so we are saying the disk request saying first go to track 65, read some data, then go to track 40, read some data, then go to track 18, read some data, and then it says go to track 78, read some data. In reality, you basically specify a track number and a sector number on that track. Okay? So the real request is going to say go to track 65, read sector 13. Then the next request may say go to track 40, read sector 25. Okay? So I am ignoring the sector numbers here because we are not worrying about rotational latency for now. We are only trying to optimize disk seek, not the rotational latency. To optimize disk seek, we just need to look at track numbers. Okay, for now. Is that clear? Okay. So we start at track number 30, and the first request says go to track 65. Okay, so the disk head is going to move from here to here. Okay, and it will service that request. Then it says go to track 40, so it's going to move back to track 40 here. Okay, then it's going to move to track 18, which is going to go all the way here, and then track 78, which goes here. Okay, so that's the order in where that. So it starts from 30. Okay, so you go from 30, go to 65, 40, 18 through 78. So then you have to see what is the total distance the disk head has moved. Okay? That total distance will determine how much time you spent seeking. So how many tracks did you have to move? So here you move 30 tracks. From here to here is 25. Okay? So that comes to 142 tracks. Okay, so you spent, you basically traverse 142 tracks back and forth, okay, to service these requests. So that's the amount of time you have essentially wasted in terms of tracks. Okay, is that clear how to do FCFS? If I give you a exam problem, it specifies a certain track ordering, or I ask you saying if construct a problem that where the disk head moves 27 tracks as I had asked you to do in midterm 1, you should be able to figure this out. Okay, so in any case, so what is important here is that the disk is not doing anything smart. Okay, just servicing requests in the order in which they come in. So if the disk, request hop back and forth saying you get a request on the inner tracks followed by request on the outer tracks followed by request on the inner track, a disk head is going to spend all its time just moving back and forth, okay, which may not be the right thing to do, as we will see. You can do better than that. Okay? During light loads, there's not much you can do. Okay? If you have only one request outstanding, there is nothing to reorder. FCFS is as good as it gets. Okay, during heavy loads where there are a whole bunch of outstanding requests, reordering them gets big wins, as we will see as well. Okay. Next one is called shortest seek time first. Okay, so what does this do? So what this is going to do is, it's going to say my disk head is currently positioned at track I. Look at all the outstanding requests. Okay, which one is the closest to the current disk head? Okay, you go and service that request. Okay, so it's a shortest seek time. So which is the shortest seek is the one you are going to service. That clear what I just said? You look at where the disk head is and you look at where the requests are. And you say, where is the closest request? You go service that. Then you say, where is the next closest request? You service that. And so on. Okay, so this is best illustrated with a picture. Okay, so this is track 0. This track 100, that's your disk. Okay, so this is currently disk head is here, track 30. Okay, so the requests that we want are shown on the previous slide. Okay, so we have an outstanding request for 65, this one for 40, 78, 80. Okay, what is shortest seek time first going to do? It's going to say, I'm at track 30. Okay, where is the closest request? Okay, so this request is 10 tracks away. This request is 12 tracks away. Okay, and these are much further off. So this is the nearest request. This is the one that requires the shortest seek. Okay, so you'll say, from 30 I'm going to go and service that request. Yeah, so you basically move your disk head, you arrive at 40, you service that request. Then you say, of the ones that are remaining, which is the next closest request? Okay. So this one is 25 tracks away. And this one is 22 tracks away. 18. Okay, because you are at 40, so the difference between these two is 22 tracks. Going from 40 to 65 is 25 tracks. Okay. So which one would you pick? Okay, so you are going to pick this one. And then you go to 65, and then you will go to 78. Okay, so you will basically go back, go here, 65, 78, 18. Okay, so you go from 30 to 40, 18, 65, 78. Okay, so that's basically what's shown there. So if you look at the total distance traversed, that is 142 tracks. Oh, sorry, not 140, that 92 tracks. Okay. So same set of requests, just by servicing them in an order different from FCFS, you reduce the seek time from 142 down to 92. Almost a 30% reduction in seek time. That's a 30% boost in your disk performance just by reordering requests. Is that clear? So this, as it turns out, is a greedy algorithm. Okay, I presume if you have done 311, you know what a greedy algorithm is. Okay, greedy algorithm is at any point, what is my greediest choice? What is the nearest request? That's the one I am going to service. Okay. So the disadvantage of this greedy algorithm is that there is potential for starvation. Okay. So typically what happens is, when you have a sequence of requests, okay, so let's say that's your disk head, this goes from 0 to 100, this is at track 30. You have the continuous arrivals of requests into your disk. You are basically always going to move to some disk requests that are close by, and these requests that are far off will starve. Okay, because there is always a closer request to service. Okay, so at high loads, your disk requests that are far off will end up starving. Okay? Just as in shortest job first, the same problem as shortest job first. There's always a small job, long jobs will wait for long periods of time. Here your short job is the one that is closest to you. Okay, shortest seek time first essentially has the same problem as shortest job first. Yeah, there's potential for starvation. Okay? But nevertheless, it does better than FCFS. I will mention here that what is done in some real disks is not just looking at the disk seek overhead, but the disk seek plus the rotational latency. Okay, so this is, since the disk surface is not a linear surface, it's a circle, circular surface. So let's say the disk head is currently at this location. Okay. There are outstanding requests. You want to read that sector, you want to read this sector, you want to read this sector. Okay, and you are here. Okay. So what you want to do is not just look at disk seek, which is just saying what's the distance from this track to this track. You want to actually look at this plus this time, which is the rotational latency. Okay, because you are going to move here and then you are going to wait for the disk to spin by. So that's the actual time you are wasting, not just the seek. Conversely, you say that's the time to go there and then this is the time to go here. Okay. So the actual algorithm that's used in hardware is what is called shortest access time first. Not seek time, but access time is defined as seek plus rotational latency. Okay. Yes, there's a question there. Go ahead. Can the disk change? No, it spins at a constant rate. The motor is going to always spin. It can spin down. It doesn't have to. If there's no request, the power management software on your OS will tell the disk spin down. Don't keep spinning when there are no requests. Okay, but once it is spinning, it's spinning at a constant rate. Okay. So this problem of shortest access time first can be solved as a traveling salesman problem. If have you done traveling TSP in 311? Yes. People have heard of TSP, I presume. Okay. Yes, it is an NP complete problem, but there are heuristics to solve the traveling salesman problem. Yeah, as you probably have heard in 311, this is a traveling salesman problem. This says, if I am here, construct a path that basically goes and hits all of these things with the least distance traveled. The least distance is the seek time and the rotational latency. That is going to give you the optimal performance because you are basically spending the least amount of time doing seeks and rotational latency. So if you model this as a TSP, okay, you will get the best performance. But clearly an NP complete problem is not something you can implement on an inexpensive controller. Yeah, because you need compute power to do this kind of stuff. So you will have very simple heuristics. If at all a disk actually does SATF, you will have very simple heuristics to do. Okay, SATF you can show is essentially, if you do a full TSP, it is optimal because there is no better thing. If you do an online TSP, which is a greedy version of SATF, which only looks at the next request and which is the closest one and service it, that will have the same starvation problem. But if you look at all of them and construct a path and service, that is actually optimal. Okay. So you don't have to know about SATF. Okay. I just mention it as an aside, saying that's really the right thing that hardware does. This is a simpler version of SATF. Just look at seek time and go to the track that is closest to you. Okay? Any questions on this? Right. So next algorithm we are going to look at is called scan scheduling. Okay, there are. It's also referred to as elevator scheduling in the literature. And the reason it's called elevator scheduling is that the way it works is the way elevators work. Okay, so if you think of an elevator, basically goes up and down. Here the disk head can be thought of as the elevator as going back and forth. Okay, at any point in time, there are some number of people who have basically pressed a button saying, I need to get into the elevator. Okay. And the elevator has to decide in what order it services them. Okay. If you use the same algorithm to service your disk request, you basically have what is called scan scheduling. And you think about how elevators work. What does an elevator do? Okay, let's say it starts at level 0. What does it do?
Goes up until the highest floor it has to, which is either the one that someone's waiting for or someone's trapped inside the elevator, and then it starts back down again.
So elevators, what do? They go up, and when there's nothing more to do going up, they turn direction, they come back down and service everybody on the way down. And then they will resume going up and they'll service everyone who wants to get in or get out going up in the same way. So you go back and forth. That's exactly what this scan scheduling does. That's why it's called a scan. You start from disk at 0 and you keep scanning all the way to disk 100. Anytime there is a request on that track, you wait you service it and then you continue the scan. Exactly what elevator would do. It will keep going up. If you need to service a floor, you will stop, service that floor, continue. Okay? Same thing. So you start a scan from 0 to 100, keep servicing requests that have arrived, and then you start a reverse scan and more requests would have arrived, and then as you hit a track with a request, you wait, you service, and then you continue the scan. So you just keep going back and forth. Okay? Very simple algorithm. Okay? So all you're doing is you're just going all the way. So the simplest one, there are two variants we'll look. There's something called scan and an optimization called look. Okay? Scan always starts at 0, goes all the way to 100, and then reverse direction goes all the way to 0. Okay? Look is just an optimization that says start at 0 and go to the highest track where there is something and don't continue. If you hit a track, there you stop at 80, there is nothing more to do, there is no point going all the way to 100 to reverse direction. You can just reverse direction from 80. Okay? So look is a variant of scan where you don't go all the way to the end. You go to the outermost track where there is a request to be serviced and then change direction and go all the way to the innermost track. So you will just go from not from 0 to 100, but from the innermost track with a request to the outermost track with a request and keep changing direction. Okay? So let's not worry about look, let's just do scan. Okay? So same request ordering. So what's the... let's do this. So this one... Forget the order. Let's write it. Okay, so this is the arrival order. This head is currently at track 30. Okay, so what's going to happen?
Are we going up or down?
Okay, first question you should ask is which direction is the disc headed? Okay, otherwise you don't know which one you will service. So let's assume, I don't know what is said on the slide, but we'll look at it. Okay, so it's saying that the disc head is currently going down. Okay, it's moving to lower numbered tracks. Okay, so disc is scanning this way. So what do we do?
Okay, so now
you will start a reverse scan. Okay, so you will go all the way to 0, switch direction, like the elevator, you reach the lowest level, switch direction, you will start going up. Okay, so now basically go to 40, pause their service, 55, 78. Okay? So that's basically what is shown here. So this I think is actually showing look, not scan, because it turned right at 18. Okay, if it had gone all the way to 0, you would have another 18 tracks there. But it's actually showing you how look would behave, which is at 18 it swapped direction. Okay. So here you brought it down in look to 72. Again, same number, same requests, just by scheduling them in a different order, you have basically gone down from 142. All the way to 72. So just reordering requests on disk gets you big gains. You have the disk seek over it in this case. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so the next and the last one, I believe it is the last one, yes, is called C-scan. This basically says you are going to scan but only in one direction. Okay, so this is like the elevator that only services or makes stops on its way up. Okay, so basically only service, so on the way down you just not stop, you'll go all the way down and then start a scan upwards. The same thing. So you can assume you only stop on the way out, So when you start from zero, you keep scanning until your request stop, continue, stop, and so on. When you reach 100, you start a reverse scan, but in the reverse you will not stop. You will go all the way to the beginning and then start a scan again. Is that clear what it does? Yes or no? Okay, so we'll talk about why this makes sense. We'll wait for just 1 second, but first let's make sure that what this does is clear. Okay, so now ask the question, why does this make sense? Why do we care? Why not stop both ways? Elevators don't do this clearly. Otherwise you could never come down or go up. Right? But why does it make sense for disks? Yes. Disks only spin one way. Not quite. Disks do spin one way, that's absolutely true. But that does not help you understand why you should only service things on the way out or on the way in, but not both ways. It's a good attempt though. Okay, yes, you have something.
Look, we're going to get clustering around certain points of the disk where those will be favored positions. I guess at the end, we're going to cluster around the end because those get passed over twice right there, and then they won't get seen again for quite a while. But this keeps it.
Okay, so that's, yes, you do, well, you don't get clustering, but you are on the right track in terms of why do this. So the answer is, if you think of an elevator, right, so think of which floors will the elevator make you wait longer. Suppose that you are in a building, let's say there are 10 floors, okay. Think of an elevator and say, does it matter which floor you are on, and if you press the button, and it makes the elevator come to you faster than some other floors. Okay. Typically, if you are on the outer floors, the inner floor or the outer floor, so if the elevator is sort of, let's say, way up, and then if you are on the bottommost floor, you press, you have to wait the longest. That's the worst possible case. If you are on some middle floors, you will wait less. So it takes less time for wherever the elevator is to come to you. Okay. Is that clear what I just said? Same is true here. Basically, when you are doing scan both ways, okay, requests that are hitting the outer or the inner tracks will have to wait longer on an average, not always. We'll have to wait longer than the requests that are in the middle. Because on an average, if the let's say two requests arrive, one is here and one is here, and the head is on this side, then this request will have to wait much longer for the disk head to move than this request. Okay? And because you're doing this in both directions, you basically favor the middle third of the disk over the outer thirds. Okay, so requests that are actually placed in the middle third will get serviced on an average much faster than requests that are hitting the disk that are on the innermost or outermost tracks. Okay. By servicing only in one direction, you get rid of this problem. Okay, so if you think about it, if the disk head is, let's say, now at 80, and a request comes for 50 and a request comes for 20, the 50 guy actually has to wait until the disk goes all the way back and starts the reverse scan. So on an average, regardless of where the disk head is, okay, you will have to wait basically half the disk distance for the disk head to come to you. Okay. So by scanning in only one direction, you essentially get more uniform wait times, which is independent of the location on disk. Because scan tends to favor the middle third, because on an average, regardless of where the disk head is, this requires the least distance for traversal. Okay, if you are even on disk 0, only traverse on the order of 30 or 40 tracks, okay, to get here, as opposed to some other things. Okay, so this is as you can show, or you can convince yourself, that this will actually result in more uniform wait time. On an average, when a request comes in, regardless of where it is, it's going to wait the same. Okay. In scan, you will basically have to wait longer if you are on the outer tracks on an average than you are inside. Okay, but this will come at an expense. Okay, so if you actually work through the same thing, So the same problem, you'll see that this is the order in which you survey. So if you are going to survey as going outwards, you'll go from 30 to, you'll go to 40, 65, 70, 18. So this gives you 108 tracks, okay, which is much higher than 72. Okay, because once you reach the outer tracks, you have to pay the price of going all the way back where you're not doing anything useful. And then you start scanning back. So you got more uniform wait time, but you made the over total disk seek higher. This is a trade-off. If you care about optimizing the disk seek alone without optimizing the average waiting time, you should go for scan. Okay? If you care about fairness, okay, that I don't penalize this request because it hits an outer track, make it wait longer on an average than if it was in the middle track, then if you want to be fair, C-scan is better. C-scan has better fairness property. Scan has better scan performance. Okay, so, depending on which metric you want to optimize, you will have to pick. You can't do both. Okay, so, this is a trade-off that you have to pick. Yes, questions?
Writing to the desk, would it be considered like the same thing as read and write?
Yes. So, what I did not mention is, reads and writes as far as the disk head is concerned, makes no difference. Okay. It's exactly the same thing. In one case, the disk head is reading bits. In the other case, it's writing bits. You have to do the same thing, regardless of whether read or write. First, do a seek. Then, do a rotational latency. Position the disk head on the right sector. At that point, you can write or you can read. Okay. So, from a performance or latency perspective, makes no difference. Okay. It takes the same overhead as the exact same call, which is why I didn't say anything about whether these requests are reads or writes. Okay. From a from a scheduling perspective, they are identical. Any questions on this? Yes, no question.
How come you don't count 100 when you go all the way back?
How come you don't count 100? That's a good point. So just as there is a scan and there is a C scan, there is a look and there is a C look. So in the C version of this, what you will do is you will go from 78, you will not go all the way to 0. You will go to the outermost request and then change direction, because there is no point going to 0 and coming back to 18. You know that's wasted work. Okay, so that's what is that optimization is what you see here. That is why you only see 60 tracks. You have actually gone all the way back and changed direction, but you stop at 18. There's no point going all the way to 0. It's like an elevator that says there is a person waiting on the first, let's say the third floor. Do I need to go all the way back to level 1 and then come here, or can I just stop here and service that person right now? Same optimization. Okay, so there are these nuances. Do you go all the way to the end, you just go to the outermost request or the outermost track? Here you are going to the outermost request, just to save on this seek performance. Okay, so I'll quickly finish these two slides on this performance. So there are some optimizations that file systems do to take care of this disk idiosyncrasies. Okay, so one big optimization is that if you actually want good sequential read performance, that you should not store adjacent blocks of the file on adjacent sectors. Okay, should not, not should. Okay, so here is a, we draw a picture and explain why. Just slightly counterintuitive, but it will make sense once you understand. Let's just take one track. Yeah, that track. Here are three sectors. Sector 0, sector 1, sector 2, sector 3 and sector 4. Five sectors. Okay, so if you are playing out a file on disk, okay, so if you actually stored, let's say, block 0 here, okay, and block 1 here, block 2 here, this actually gives you worse performance when you try to read this file sequentially. Okay. Why is that? The reason is, so let's say if you want to read this file sequentially, you are going to send it, let's say this is track So you are going to send it, request that look like this. Go to track 5, read sector 0. Go to track 5, read sector 1. Go to track 5, read sector 2. Which are basically these sectors. Okay? So, first block is not a problem. You will basically position the disk head here and then read this sector. Okay, and you have just finished that sector. Then you go and see what is the next outstanding request. Okay, you say, okay, that's sector, the track 5, sector 1. You say, am I already on the right track? Yes. So now I need to wait, read sector 1. Okay? But the time it takes for the hardware to do this, the sector has already started to spin by. The disk is continuously spinning. Okay, so as soon as you basically the next bit, this is the last bit of this sector, the next bit is right here. So unless your hardware works faster than the time it takes for the next bit to spin by, to make this decision, this sector has already started spinning by, so you can't read it anymore. Okay, because too late, because you sort of the sector is already, so you are actually somewhere in the middle of the sector. Your head is somewhere in the middle, so you have to wait for a whole rotation to come back and read the next sector. Okay, is that problem clear, what I just said?
Yes. Would the hardware be intelligent enough to read 5.2 and then go back to 5.1 if it recognizes that happen?
Would you read 5.2 and read 5.1? You could do that, but then you still have wasted one whole rotation. So the point is, if you laid out adjacent blocks of the file contiguously, you have this problem because hardware is fast, but it doesn't make instantaneous decisions, and the disk ain't waiting for you to figure out what the next sector is. The next sector will start spinning by and say, oh, too late, I have to wait for it to spin by again. Okay? So the simple solution here is what is called interleaving. Interleaving just says skip a sector. Okay, so don't store adjacent blocks contiguously. Basically store them on adjacent sector. Put them on odd numbered sector. So what you will do, okay, you put the first block here. The next block of that file can store here, leave one sector here. Okay, put something else there. The third block, again skip a sector, put it on the next one, and so on. Okay. So now what your request look like is, say, go read one. The next block of the file is actually this sector. The next block is this sector. Okay, so why? So here you do have the time. Because by the time you finish this and you process the next thing, you say, okay, it's just going to come by. In the next whatever microseconds, you wait for this sector to spin by, you read it. And you say, what's the next one? And by that time, the disk has already started spinning, so you know it's already going to come by soon, so you read. So you actually get much better performance if you do this interleaving. Okay? Same kind of interleaving happens when you basically go from one track to another. Okay, so if your file ends, let's say this is 2, 4, 6. Okay, on this sector, then you basically overflow into the next track. You basically, the time it takes you to switch here, you better leave some gap. So the continuation of the file, the next block should be somewhere here. So when you go from here to here, if it's this exactly the next sector, it would have already spun by. Okay, so you basically stagger the placement just a little to allow for all your disk head movement and this processing to take place. This is called disk interleaving. This is a optimization that the file systems will do to get you better performance for sequential access. Okay, so don't store data contiguously, store them close to one another, but leave small gaps in between to allow for the hardware to make its decision. That's basically the bottom line. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? So the first performance optimization. As I said, none of these makes sense if you have solid state drives. So you can put data wherever you want. This scheduling you will do in SSDs is FCFS. There's no reason to reorder anything. So you can go wherever you want and retrieve data at full speed. Yes, question.
So, how in general the OS would need to react to, whatever blocks it read? But it seems like in certain applications, the OS can say ahead of time, like, I need to read pages from here to here, for example, in a database system. Would there be some way of turning off interleaving there because interleaving would...
Yeah, so that is read ahead. Interleaving and read ahead are not, you don't have to turn off interleaving, but you can actually read data that's not yet requested to optimize for things. Okay. So read ahead is yet another performance optimization that most file systems will perform. Okay, what they do is, because when you open a file, the file system or the operating system does not know how the application is going to access it. It could be sequential access or it could be random access. So the file system has to figure out what kind of access this file is seeing. Okay? If it sees sequential access, then what the file system will do is it will start prefetching the blocks of the file even before the application requests it. So if you say, if you see a request for block 0, you see a request for block 1, you see a request for block 2, file system will say, you read 3 blocks in a row, you must be accessing this file sequentially. So let me go ahead and read 4, 5 and 6 for you even before you send off these requests. So it will send off these requests to the disk on behalf of the application and read these blocks and store it in memory into a buffer cache. Okay? When the request arrives, you always check the buffer cache, saying, is the data already in, has it been read previously, it's already cached in memory. If it's cached in memory, your results are returned immediately. If it is not cached, you have to actually go and fetch it from disk. So if you perform read ahead, okay, this gives you good gains for sequential access because you are already reading data. You are way ahead of the application and you are reading data that the application is going to access in the near future. Data already arrives in memory even before the disk or the application requests it. So when the request hits the OS can return the results immediately and the application sees very good performance. Okay? So yet another optimization to do, which is read blocks ahead of the request. Okay? So this will actually reduce the number of seeks as well, okay, because that's what was actually mentioned. It is a performance optimization. This is very similar to prefetching virtual memory pages. Okay, so when I was talking about virtual memory, I said you can reduce the page fault rate by prefetching pages. If you know what the application is going to access in the near future, you can prefetch those pages and reduce the page fault rate and improve performance. Same kind of optimization is true here. Okay? Again, like in the virtual memory, this is not a guarantee. If the operating system guesses wrong and you decide prefetches more data than the application needs, you just wasted a lot of disk IOs doing way work that is not useful. Because there is no guarantee that you will read the whole file. You may only read the first quarter of the file and the file system may have prefetched more data than it needs to. So it can make educated guesses, but it is not a sure thing because you cannot really predict what applications will do. Okay, but it works well lots of the times. So most operating systems will do this for you. Okay. So that's the discussion on disks. Okay, I want to spend maybe 2 slides talking about other devices like tertiary storage. Okay. Typically tertiary storage is used to do backups. Yeah, so good example of tertiary storage is tape disks, tape drives. Okay. So they are large spools that look like a large version of, let's say, a VCR tape that can store data. Okay, they can store lots of data. Typically, they are used to do off-site backups of your data. So, if your building goes up in smoke, your data is still there for you. Okay. Now, until recently, tapes were cheaper than disks. Okay, so, it made sense to keep backups on tapes. Okay, but the prices of disks have fallen so much that these days backup devices are constructed using disks themselves. Okay? So until about 5-10 years ago, every night a backup process would run. It would take all of the data from your server, dump it onto a tape drive, and the tape drive would be shipped off to some offsite location and stored there in some vault. Okay? So if something happens, then you can go and retrieve it. Okay? But the cost of tapes has not fallen as much. The cost of disks have basically halved every other year. This is Moore's law. So disks keep getting bigger and they also get cheaper. So these days you would actually do backups using bigger, cheaper disks rather than using tapes. Okay, but that said, it's still instructive to look at a few of these other devices. Okay. So different types of devices. Tape drives are the most common backup devices. There are removable devices which include zip drives, USB thumb drives, whole bunch of these devices, your external USB drives that you can plug in to do backups. Those are all used. Optical drives are still used. You can use DVDs to do backups. And then there are these automated, very expensive robotic jukeboxes. Okay, just as you go to this restaurant and you can say, go to this CD, robotic CD thing and say, I want to play this song. It takes this CD, pops it in, starts playing the song. Same thing you can do to do backups. Okay, you have this library of tape drives. You can tell it, go to tape 10 and pop it in and do a backup on tape 10. So it will automatically put load that. So you don't need a human to go and take the tape out and put a new tape in. A small robot sitting there putting the tape in and taking the tape out and so on. Okay, so these devices cost money. Okay, so you don't see them everywhere, but they are in existence and you can use those. Okay, now the big difference between, the only thing I really want all of you to keep in mind is, the big difference between magnetic disks and tape drives is that tape drives are linear access devices. Random access on tape drives is extremely slow. Okay, this is, as I was mentioning the other day, if you watch a movie on a DVD drive, using a DVD and using a VCR, okay, if you want to seek to a particular location in the movie on the VCR, you have to do fast forward. You have to wait until the tape winds to that location and then play. That can take on the order of minutes. In a DVD, you can just find a chapter and jump there. Okay, that's nearly instantaneous. So discs basically allow you good random access. These things allow you very poor random access. Okay? But that's okay, because if you are using it for backup, you are just going to write out a big set of files, okay, whatever files you want to backup linearly. Okay? There is no random access involved in the backup program. Okay? So that most of the time that works out fine. Okay? But the important thing is that these devices have almost become obsolete. In a few years you will probably be using these as your tape equivalent to tape drives to do backup, because they are cheap. You'll use SSDs to store your primary data. Okay, because that's basically where the price point of these devices is headed. Okay, so I already mentioned most of these things. Economical medium. So robotic tape drives already mentioned. So okay, so the last concept I'm going to talk about here is what is called an array of disks or RAID. Okay, so a few minutes here. So if you want to construct a very large storage medium, you need to basically harness the power of multiple disks. Okay? One disk, maybe you can have 1 terabyte. But for very large applications, 1 terabyte is nothing. Okay, you may have databases that may be 100 terabytes, that may be a petabyte. Okay, no single disk can store all of this data. Okay? So the way you will actually be able to satisfy the needs of these very large applications is to construct larger storage devices using lots of little devices. Okay? So the way you do this in storage is what is called a disk array. Disk array is essentially an array of disks. It's a storage device where there are more than one disk. Okay? And this array gives you a logical abstraction of one gigantic disk, whose capacity is the sum of the capacities of individual disks. Okay, so what is shown here in the first row there is 4 disks. Okay, and these 4 disks are not presented as 4 individual disks to the OS. The hardware presents this entire array of 4 disks as one gigantic disk. Okay, if each disk is 100 gigabytes, you will see a 400 gigabyte storage volume. Okay, the hardware maintains the mapping of how files are stored across all these disks. So the OS just sees one bigger disk. Okay. This abstraction is called RAID, a redundant array of independent disks. That's the acronym for RAID. Okay. What are all these pictures? I don't have too much time. I'll come back to this next time. But the big issue really when you have very large storage devices is the ability to deal with disk failures. Okay. What happens in RAID devices is, you take a file, you will chop it up into blocks, just as you do in a normal file system. But then you scatter these blocks on different disks. So a file is not stored on a single disk. A file is chopped up into pieces and stored on multiple disks. So block 1 will go on disk 0. Block 1 of the file goes on disk 1. Block 2 of the same file goes on disk 2. So there are pieces of the file that are scattered across multiple disks. Okay, in a normal file system, the entire file stored on a single disk. In a RAID system, a file is stored on multiple disks. So now what happens is if one of these disks fails, let's say just gets corrupted or goes bad, then every file that you have stored on this device basically becomes unavailable, because one nth of that file's data is on that disk, if there are n disks in the system. Okay. If you had managed those disks independently, the failure of one disk only causes files that are on that disk to basically go away. Okay. You manage them as a RAID array, then if any one disk fails, then all files become unavailable. Okay. And as you have very large arrays, you can have disk storage system with 100 disks, with 1000 disks and so on. Okay. The probability of a failure keeps going up. So you need to build redundancy into the storage system. Okay. You need to keep extra copies of your data, so that if any one disk goes down, the system as a whole continues to run. The file system doesn't say, one disk has failed, tough luck, all your files are gone. It shouldn't say that. It should say, one disk has failed, but that doesn't matter, I can still get your file data for you. Okay? So I'll come back next time and we'll look at all these other things here and see how these RAID devices can keep extra data to ensure high availability in spite of disk failures. Okay? So this is what you will see in modern servers. If you go to any server room or any large server, it will essentially have a RAID array on it. Okay? RAID array will have multiple disks. So disks are presented as single logical disk, but they can also tolerate disk failures. The disks can go down, can pull a disk out, still your data is available because there is extra copies of it stored in the system. Okay. So that's RAID, we'll come back to that. So let me stop here and I can hand out the exam.